From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll learn how a community benefits agreement at the Deer District led to a new union representing Milwaukee service and hospitality workers. Then we'll learn about efforts to prevent future flooding in the Milwaukee area.
We've gotten much more than the ground can absorb. Normally, either it'd be frozen ground and it would get to our streams very quickly, but now even the ground's full of water and there's no place for it to go.
Plus, we'll speak with one of just two female master cheesemakers in the world who's making cheese right here in Wisconsin.
It challenges a person intellectually. As cheesemakers, we have to listen to the process and make adjustments to the process based on what the milk is doing or what the curd is doing. It's not the same every day.
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. Before the Deer District was even constructed, there was a lot of talk about what it would mean for Milwaukee. Developers claimed the new space would bring more money and life to the downtown neighborhood. And above all else, it would lead to jobs. But the kinds of jobs that come with a new entertainment district are often low income, low stability, and high stress. The kinds of jobs that Laura Dresser would consider bad. Dresser is the associate director of the High Road Strategy Center, a think tank that in part looks at employment conditions in Wisconsin. But in the case of the Deer District, developers created a community benefits agreement, ensuring certain rights for its future employees. That led to the creation of MASH, the Milwaukee Area Service and Hospitality Workers Organization, a labor union that represents these workers. A recent report from High Road details the benefits this union and agreement has brought to its workers. Dresser joins me now along with Peter Rickman, the president of MASH. Thank you both so much for being here.
Thanks for having us.
What is a community benefits agreement?
A community benefits agreement is a kind of agreement that a developer and a private community group that represents community interest can make. There's also community benefits agreements that are made directly between developers and local units of government. That's not as possible in the state of Wisconsin. Here, it's a private arrangement. But the local unit of government, the city or the county, can say, we want to make sure that this development matters to workers and this community and solves problems that we have. And so make sure that you make a deal that we can believe in. And that's, I think, the story of Milwaukee. It's an agreement between a community group and a developer about the terms of the development.
I think one of the critical aspects about a community benefits agreement has to be binding agreement between two parties that holds a developer accountable. So oftentimes, developers bring projects forward with big promises about all the good that will come if we just build this building, if we just subsidize this mixed-use project. Sunshine, puppies, rainbows, and economic prosperity for all will come. But only with a binding, legally binding community benefits agreement can people of a neighborhood or a whole city or a region be certain that the promises made by developers, once they're put on paper, will actually come true.
Yeah, it does feel like accountability is one of the big aspects of this. As you say, one of the questions I had in reading this report, of course, was, you know, is it necessary to have a union? Because when the community benefits agreement was first crafted, the union was not seemingly a part of that. That was something that kind of predated MASH's maybe official involvement with workers at the Deer District. Is that right?
I think the best way to think about what happened through the landmark Deer District Community Benefits Agreement is that when the Bucks brought forward this vision for redevelopment of a major swath of downtown centered on a brand new arena, there was a possibility to begin transforming service and hospitality employment in Milwaukee. And the community benefits agreement that emerged involved some big components, like a workforce development approach that would put workers at the center of the project in all of its life cycle. Wage standards that we had never seen here in Wisconsin, and union rights. Now, to monitor and enforce that kind of binding community benefits agreement, you need some kind of organization. Without some kind of organization to monitor, enforce, and implement that community benefits agreement, we'd end up in a situation where it's just like developers make promises that never come true. And those of us who ran that campaign and negotiated the community benefits agreement said, well, we should build an organization fit for purpose to monitor and enforce and implement this community benefits agreement now and long into the future. And that's what gave birth to MASH as an organization, is that work around the community benefits agreement. And we don't separate the union from the workforce development aspects from the wage standard things. So MASH was actually born to implement that community benefits agreement and carry it forward, and critically here, expand it across other developments, which I think is one of the key components to this report. Is we've got the blueprint here from the Deer District Community Benefits Agreement that we can apply across the board for future projects like the proposed Iron District, like the Convention Center Headquarters Hotel or other downtown hotel developments.
And I want to just jump back to one aspect about labor in the Community Benefits Agreement, just to help put a point in this. In the Community Benefits Agreement, there were a number of things about the work. One was some wage standards for that work. One was labor peace for the people who will do that work. That means that if those workers want a union, the developer is agreeing they're not going to stand in the way of that. They're not going to slow that down. They're not going to lay off the workers that are organizing. They agree that if the workers sign cards, want a union, they're going to get a union. They're going to get an honest effort to bargain a first contract. Labor peace allows unionization when workers want it in a way that our federal labor law really doesn't.
Now, Laura, you and I have talked before about bad jobs, the proliferation of bad jobs in the state of Wisconsin and especially here in Milwaukee. And many of those bad jobs have historically been in the service and hospitality arena. What are the kinds of jobs that came out of this initial agreement with the Deer District?
I mean, I think there's a core of these jobs that have traditionally or been structured is pretty bad jobs. And just to remind folks, a bad job tends to come in a bad package. That means that low wages come alongside volatile, low hours, few benefits, very little voice on the job. Our service sector is kind of marked by that kind of work, the low wage service jobs. And it's food service workers, security workers, janitors, and then there are other low-wage jobs that are not so implicated by an entertainment district in home health care and child care and other places. But this core is food service, concessions, bartending, event security, and janitorial.
How have we seen the conditions for those jobs improve as a result of this agreement?
I think we too often imagine that jobs are created in some idealized space and they come with their conditions independent of political context, organizing, or regulatory structures. So we think of these jobs as necessarily sometimes or inherently low wage. It's interesting that in the early part of the previous century that we thought of manufacturing jobs, naturalized them as necessarily low wage, and unions changed that. In this case, again, it's a union, the power of worker voice to help define the conditions of the work and change those conditions. And I think you can see that in the wage increases. This most recent contract that was ratified at the end of the summer and into the fall shows really strong wage increases for these workers, and also points where labor and management together are asking the union or figuring out how the union is solving scheduling and shift issues. And this is enormously important to workers in these jobs, that which can have kind of lower hours than they need, and they need to see how they're going to make real income out of it. And so you can see those kinds of strategies going on in this contract to raise the floor on these jobs.
One of the really critical aspects about workers being represented by a union and being covered by a strong contract that often goes missing because folks concentrate so much on the union difference with wages, which is tremendous. I mean, everybody knows with a union and a contract, the vast majority of workers make much higher wages. But what's missing is the balance of power in the workplace. You know, without a union, bosses have all the power in workplaces. Here in America, when we punch in at work, we check out our rights. But with a union and a contract, that power is balanced between a group of workers and the employer. And so we come to the table then as equals to negotiate on everything. And that means worker voice and a seat at the table on things like policies and procedures. A union and a contract, you know, means that every decision made by an employer when it comes to discipline and the way that policies and rules are implemented is according to a legal standard of just cause. That means an employer has to have a good reason for doing things, not just whatever arbitrary whim possesses some frontline manager on any given day. A union and a contract means that if there's a dispute in the workplace about how a policy is interpreted or whether or not a rule's been broken, or frankly, if the employer doesn't do what it's supposed to do in terms of even paying people properly, there's a quasi-judicial mechanism that allows workers to hold employers accountable. But it's about dignity, rights, and respect on the job. And if we're going to build a Milwaukee for all of us, if we're going to move beyond the racialized income inequality economy that defines this city and far too many places around the country, it's not going to be because we simply hope that enough small businesses are created or that, you know, entrepreneurs will us out of, you know, this stage of the way the economy has created income inequality. It's going to be because we transform the service and hospitality jobs that employ roughly 1 in 5 working Milwaukeeans into the good family supporting union jobs that once defined workers in our neighborhoods across this city.
How do you see this model serving potentially other jobs that are often, you know, categorized as bad jobs? You were mentioning nursing jobs, for example. There are many different workforces that, yeah, are unfortunately a little unstable, often have variable schedules and very low pay. Do you see this model working for them?
Yeah, I mean, I want to just jump on, you know, one point is that I think it's hard for employers to project forward how changing conditions will actually help them. They just see the demand, right? This is why employers before a minimum wage increase talk about the disaster that's coming. But what we've had is a national experiment, a 10-year experiment in dramatically increasing minimum wages. And the disasters haven't come because the experience of having a higher reward in work means that there is a kind of mutuality and a greater ability to survive on the jobs. And so even the regulation, this is outside of the voice points that Peter is making about unions, but even just raising the floor gets resisted a lot as if it's going to be a disaster. But we've seen again and again and again, it's not a disaster. And I think that's because it's really hard for employers to project forward what it means to work in a different relationship. And that's even more true with unions. It's really hard for employers who have, you know, in this labor market, in this economy where we've set up this idea that the workers will earn more. Yes, that's true. They'll also produce more and you'll have a way to negotiate problems. And so those other clauses just don't come into people's minds. And so for me, one thing is just to hold up the example and show what is possible, that a different way of doing service work is possible, and that it requires different institutions and different arrangements between workers and employers. And I think that's true. If you're going to look at anywhere in the service sector, you need to think about different institutional arrangements. And always the question will be, how much power do workers have to define the jobs, to improve the jobs, to be at the table about the jobs? And so the question of the relative power of workers and management gets answered by unions. It gets answered, you know, in short-term ways in tight labor markets. It gets answered with higher regulation that gives workers a little more power. So all of those are ways to move towards that. But I think it really does matter for service work very broadly to think about the ways workers can come together and demand more, whether it's public sector work from the government in terms of reimbursements for long-term care, or whether it's the private sector, what wages in the hospitality industry look like.
For sure. Well, Laura, Peter, thank you both so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
For the union men and women standing up and standing strong.
Help. Laura Dresser is the Associate Director of the High Road Strategy Center, formerly known as COWS. Peter Rickman is the President of the Milwaukee Area Service and Hospitality Workers Organization, also known as MASH. At WUWM.com, you can find a link to the report titled From Community Benefits to Collective Bargaining and Back.
On that front line for Joe Hill and Cesar Chavez, who fought in their own time for our brothers and our sisters up and down that picket line for the unnamed and unnumbered.
From Milwaukee's NPR, this is Capital Notes. We break down the big political news affecting Wisconsin. I'm Ayan Silver, speaking with J.R. Ross, editor of WisPolitics.com. He provides a roundup of the Wisconsin developments you need to know. Here's our latest conversation. Hi, JR. Welcome back to Capital Notes.
Thanks for having me.
Let's turn for a minute to the U.S. Senate race this year. We haven't talked about that a lot yet on Capital Notes. It's longtime Democratic Senator Tammy Baldwin seeking re-election against Eric Hovde. He's a California/Utah businessman who was born and raised in Wisconsin. He may face some nominal August primary challenges. What do we need to know about this race?
Well, the big development recently was that Donald Trump endorsed Eric Hovde, called him a great guy, and gave him his full and complete endorsement, which isn't really a surprise, but it also creates this kind of dance that Republicans often do with Donald Trump, because there's no denying that Trump brings out a certain segment of the base unlike anybody else. He has a passionate following, and those folks, if you want them to support you, you need credibility, and Donald Trump provides that. The flip side is Trump has lost the suburbs, a lot of areas, not doing as well there as past Republicans, and the party has suffered because of it. And so how does Eric Hovde embrace that Trump endorsement and get that support from outstate that he needs, places like Western Wisconsin and Northern Wisconsin, where Trump is very popular, without losing support in the suburbs? We saw some evidence of how he's trying to create some distance between himself and Trump this past week. Examples, you know, he said he doesn't believe the election in 2020 was stolen. Trump continues to harp that theme, did in Green Bay during his rally. Hovde says, look, they thought there were problems, but no, it wasn't stolen. On abortion, he's tried to kind of navigate that issue by saying that he believes in life, but also believes that a woman should have a choice early on in her pregnancy. That's different from where he was back in 2012 when he ran for U.S. Senate and said he was totally opposed to abortion. So you're seeing kind of the pluses and minuses of the Trump endorsement and Hovde having to try to navigate that while also broadening the appeal that he has. Because you look at the polls and Donald Trump and Joe Biden, they're both kind of stuck in the mid-40s, maybe upper mid-40s. But that's not how it's going to play out in the Senate race. You know, we're probably going to have some third-party votes in the presidential race. Robert F. Kennedy Jr., you know, Jill Stein, Cornel West, that might keep both Trump and Biden below 50%, but it's not going to be as crowded a ballot, we don't think, at least right now, in the Senate race. So if Trump's at 48%, just pulling a number out of thin air, how does Hovde get to 50 against Tammy Baldwin? He has to broaden that appeal, expand the number of people who are interested in him beyond what Donald Trump can offer, but also how do you do that without losing that hardcore MAGA base?
Well, looking at Hovde and Baldwin, can you kind of lay out for voters what they should know about the candidates, you know, in terms of where they stand on big issues? You've mentioned Hovde, abortion, a little bit.
Yeah, Hovde ran in 2012. He's running again this year. He's toyed the idea of running for a number of elections over the years. Madison businessman, native of Wisconsin, being knocked by Democrats because he owns a bank in California, has a very nice home out there. He has staked out kind of things like immigration, the border, drugs coming across, fentanyl, kind of like the core. But basically, the issues that you're seeing really Trump talk about are the ones he's talking about, trying to bring the country together, solving healthcare, those kinds of things. Baldwin first ran for the county board in Dane County back in the 80s, I want to say, served in the assembly, went to the Congress, won the Senate seat in 2012 when she beat Tommy Thompson, easily won re-election in 2018. This race is a little bit different for her, though, because in 2018, she had an opponent who really didn't get off the ground post-primary, couldn't really raise money. Leah Vukmir is a state senator. She struggled that race. Hovde's got personal wealth, and we don't know how much, but he's going to put in the race. But we do know that his campaign says he raised at least $1 million from others the time he got in mid-February through the end of March. We will see exactly what he raised by mid-April when FEC reports are due. We know he's got close to $5 million up on the air so far. So we know he's put personal money in. Again, don't know how much for sure just yet, but that's there. Tammy Baldwin has been a pretty steady Democratic vote in her caucus. She has tried to play up her bipartisan credentials at times by her one of her first ads talked about a law she pushed that was supported by both Donald Trump and Joe Biden. She's talked about Buy American quite a bit. She authored legislation to provide some legal protections for gay marriage. So, you know, she's been around for a long time, and that's something that Huffy's trying to use against her, that she's a career politician, in his words, and it's time for change, whereas Baldwin continues to sell her appeal like she's somebody gets things done for Wisconsin. She regularly shows up in all parts of the state touting Project X or Y that she got a grant for to help fund it and tout that she's somebody who's bringing things home for the state.
So how worried are Democrats about losing this seat?
They're cautiously optimistic. They feel like Tammy Baldwin does the work once she gets up on the air in more meaningful ways and continues to hammer her issues and people know more about Hovde that she'll be okay. But Republicans are at least optimistic. You know, people were kind of not even paying attention to this race a year ago. Like, oh, she won by so much in 2018. How's it going to be competitive? Well, that ignored the dynamic of that race. She had so much more money in 2018 than Leah Vukmir that she ran ads in the Wausau market in western Wisconsin in ways that Vukmir couldn't run up numbers there that no Democrat usually does. If it's a 50-50 presidential race, anything can happen in Wisconsin, and it goes in the Senate race. And that goes back to the question of between Baldwin and Hovde, who can best run ahead of the top of their ticket for president in November? That could be the key, is who's got more appeal beyond whatever hard ceiling they may face because of Joe Biden or Donald Trump.
You're tuned into Capitol Notes. I'm Ayan Silver, speaking with J.R. Ross, editor of WizPolitics.com. So thanks for that information about the Senate race. It's also another week, another election gone by in Wisconsin. Voters narrowly passed two constitutional amendments brought by Republicans in the legislature, and now private funds can't be used to run elections. Can you tell us about this and what practical effect it'll have?
No more, Republicans call them Zuckerbucks. Basically, back in 2020, it's all reaction to 2020, and there was a series of grants handed out to local governments in Wisconsin, about $10 million statewide to almost 200 communities by a group largely funded by Mark Zuckerberg, the Facebook founder. Of that $10 million, though, like $8.8 million went to five cities, the largest in Wisconsin, all happened to vote fairly Democratic in elections. And Republicans cried foul that this was tilting the playing field toward Democrats. I feel like it was inappropriate. So you can't do that anymore. Now, the second question, restricting who can work on election, there's little gray area there. There might have to be some legislation to clarify what that means. There have been all kinds of worries from various local election officials that, well, does this mean X, that somebody who's done this task for me for years no longer can do it? We'll see. I'm not a lawyer, so I'm not going to try and tell you what the limits are going to be, but that's something to watch is where it goes. But again, all reaction to 2020. What was the
strategy behind trying to get that into the Constitution, that only election officials can run elections? You know, can you unpack that?
Sure. There was stories about Green Bay and a consultant who helped with the election administration up there. The Republicans feel like that person had a Democratic background and it was inappropriate, the role that he played in 2020, and they didn't want to see that again. So that's why they passed that. And the reason it went to amendment was Governor Evers vetoed their attempts at reveal legislation. I mean, Governor Evers has now got close to 190 vetoes of bills since he became governor. That is a record in Wisconsin history, and Republicans have been stymied by him over and over again. So, okay, if we can't get it through the governor, we'll go to the constitutional amendment process, which requires passing it in two successive legislative sessions, then going to voters for a referendum, then doing it that way.
And so the disadvantage now is that there's more regulation, or people's hands are tied in some senses, potentially, in terms of who can help out with the election?
Potentially. Republicans have argued that these fears are overblown, that it's a red herring. But, you know, it's like anything. Until their courts weigh in, or, you know, there's trailer legislation to clarify things, there's going to be some questions that people are going to worry about what is and isn't allowed under the Constitution now with these restrictions.
And so getting back to the funding aspect, now that private funds can't be used to run elections, some election clerks have said that they only received a fraction of the federal dollars that they would need to pay for running their version, you know, running the presidential election, and then they only get a fraction from local funds. Will there be increased supplemental sources of funding in Wisconsin, whether it's local or federal?
Excellent question. You know, it's one of the things that they may address in the budget next year. They do that every 2 years, set a budget. Will that be a debate in 2025? Possibly. So yeah, it's an open question about what they're going to do if they're going to address this dynamic now and put more money into it.
And what about for 2024? Are there any concerns and options for clerks that aren't getting the money that they need?
Unless the state ponies up or the federal government does, no, not right now. There's no way to go get private funds to cover public administrative costs for elections.
And so with Wisconsin's, what does Wisconsin's legislative cycle look like for the rest of the year before the November election, and could people get something done on this?
Oh, the legislature's adjourned. I mean, they can always come back in special session, but it doesn't look like they're going to. They ended the session in mid-March, basically, and went home to go campaign. So if it's going to be addressed, barring some kind of special move, it won't be addressed until 2025.
So what do you see as the consequences of municipalities and counties not having enough money to run elections?
It depends. You know, remember, the legislature disapproved a big boost in shared revenue, which is state aid to local governments. So there's more money coming in that regard. I'm not sure how much that could help. I can't tell you, like, community by community what's going to look like. But they've run them before, the thinking is, and they'll figure out a way to run them again. So until there's proven or a need that wins over Republican lawmakers, I don't know they're going to get any more money this year for election administrative costs.
And this Center for Tech and Civic Life, were they expecting, or do you know if it was expected that they would have provided money for 2024? And have any other states banned this type of action?
Sure, other states have banned it. And I do know there's an example like Madison got some private funding for some things. They knew this amendment was coming, went and spent the money beforehand. I've seen other local governments saying, hey, we were planning to apply for X or Y, but now we won't. So there'll be a real impact. And, it, you know, I'm not sure what it's going to do yet, though. It's hard to say until we get to election day what the turnout's going to look like, what the demands are going to be in local officials, and if there's going to be a significant factor or not.
Right. All right. Well, thanks for this background, JR, and thanks for joining me on Capital Notes.
Anytime.
That was WUWM's Mayan Silver speaking with J.R. Ross of WisPolitics. You can hear Capital Notes every other Monday on Lake Effect. With the spring election behind us, now we're looking ahead to the Republican National Convention in July. Do you have questions about Milwaukee hosting the RNC? Fill out our election survey at WUWM.com. What you tell us will help inform the stories you hear on Lake Effect and WUWM. There are only two women in the world with a master cheesemaker title, and one of them makes cheese right here in Wisconsin. We'll speak with her in about 10 minutes. But first, we'll learn about work being done here in the Milwaukee area to prevent future flooding after some communities experienced heavy rains. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Last week's heavy rain led to flooding in several Milwaukee area communities. The Milwaukee Metropolitan Sewerage District issued an overflow alert. That means it released water and sewage into local waterways in the hopes of preventing basement backups. There are local groups looking for environmental solutions to prevent flooding and the need for overflow dumping. The Southeastern Wisconsin Regional Planning Commission is one of them. It partners with MMSD to work towards flooding solutions, especially as weather becomes more unpredictable.
Laura Cluddy Herrick is the chief environmental engineer for Sewer Pack. She joined WUWM's environmental reporter Susan Bentz along the flooded Fox River in Waukesha to talk about flood mitigation efforts.
You're looking regionally at what's going on with
Correct. Our
floodplains, everything we do with our land and under our land.
Yep, we do a lot of large floodplain studies for our communities. Right now we're looking at the Root River, the whole upper Root River, redoing basically where is the flooding going to occur. And we've also done stormwater work as well.
So how far ahead can you project in this work?
Lots of times we use historical data, I'll admit. Really historical flows on the streams is usually what's used to decide, well, where would flooding be, you know, elevation-wise. Forward-looking, you know, a lot of work's being done right now on what's our future rains going to be. Haven't quite figured out how that can be used, but some communities are starting to look at that when they are looking at improving a storm sewer or doing, you know, drainage studies. They might put that larger storm event in just to say, what would happen? Where would the water go if it can't fit in our pipes? Would it go down our streets? Would it impact buildings? Those sorts of things.
So when you think of the life of the Fox River over just your career, what have you seen happening on this, within this watershed?
Definitely growth, a lot of new development, which means a lot of impervious surface. So that means not as much area for the water to soak into the ground. This year's a unique case in that we've gotten about four times as much water as we usually get in March.
Let's just pause a minute. Four times.
Mm-hmm. I just looked at the rain gauge data before I talked to you, and we've gotten much more than the ground can absorb. You know, normally either it'd be frozen ground and it would get to our streams very quickly, but now even the ground's full of water and there's no place for it to go.
Tell me a little bit about the workings of your works. Is your research directed by communities within the Sewer Pack region, and that's what you pursue?
We had originally, when we came into existence in the 70s, we did do a watershed plan for all of the major watersheds in the region, the Fox, the Menominee, the Milwaukee River, etc. Now we do updates typically at the request of a community, or if they've just experienced a large flood, we may do an updated study. And it's a very time-consuming effort to do an updated study, especially of a bigger watershed like the Fox. Actually, the DNR, Wisconsin DNR, has done updated floodplain mapping on the Fox. So not only do we do it, other entities, consultants do it as well. Updating a floodplain study is a significant effort in that you're doing cross-sections of the stream every couple hundred of feet for whatever section you're interested in, and then you're updating usually the flows as well, which means looking at the whole watershed, where our impervious surfaces. It can be years to update a floodplain map and get it all the way from inception to a new FEMA map that the public sees. It's a significant effort.
So when I met with MMSD, we talked about their Green Seams program, the idea of setting land aside, mm-hmm, that is sort of naturally created to absorb this kind of thing. In your work, would you look at those kind of projects?
We definitely recommend those kind of natural projects or opportunities to absorb the water where it falls. It's way easier to do in little pieces than when it's at this point in the Fox. We have quite a bit of drainage area upstream and it's a lot of water. Definitely communities are definitely looking at green infrastructure, or even the reforestation program that MMSD is doing would help as well. You know, that root system for trees also helps infiltrate more water also. We do some of those initial studies for their projects. Like we did the initial modeling for the Kinnickinnick, all the work being done on the Kinnickinnick River right now. The Honey Creek floodplains we also did that they are continuing forward with on some of the Army Corps work being done on lower Honey Creek. We definitely interact with them a lot on especially the rivers and the floodplain mapping, at least in my world. But we do have other efforts now that we're going to be helping them with their green infrastructure program and their reforestry program. We have a couple of good botanists on staff who are going to be helping MMSD implement that throughout and they work beyond their service area. They're actually working in the upper Milwaukee watershed. I don't know if they talked about that. Their Green Seams program is buying up land actually in Washington and Ozaukee County outside of their jurisdiction, but all that water flows into their jurisdiction.
So the reforestation, is that something that you're closely connected with?
That's really Tom's. The other half of the environmental group is Tom Slosky, mm-hmm. our chief biologist, and he's leading up that program, as well as we're trying to finish our natural areas plan right now, and that has some overlap as well. My understanding, and Tom would know better, is we're going to help them find priority sites to do that. Good spots to do that, because we don't want to put a forest where it used to be a prairie historically, and we have good, you know, historical photos going back to the 1960s and 1930s, I think, at the state level. You can sometimes look and see what was there originally, where could we best restore.
Do you have counterparts around the state, or how is it that Sewer PAC came to be?
We came to be in 1960 at the request of our communities. We are by far the largest from a staffing perspective. Most of the other regional plan commissions are much smaller than us and really don't get to do the floodplain and natural resources and water quality work that we do. We're kind of unique in that respect in the state.
So that's just because you're so darn good, or that we're such
a... early on, that's where most of our funding came, actually, when we were first formed, was much more water quality focused, whereas now... Quite frankly, a lot of our funding is for transportation planning.
Well, I was
kind of switched.
Yeah.
But I think we've done so much great work, especially we were the first ones ever to do this planning on a watershed scale. And we've survived and done good work and continue.
So what's an example of some of that work, some of your research that led to projects that are, you know, tending to our waters, tending to what falls from the sky?
Well, we have looked at a couple of dams in the region recently, the Horlick Dam in Racine County. We actually looked at as part of our Root River Watershed Restoration Plan, which looked at a lot of other practices, but that's actually a dam that's being considered for removal right now by the local community. We did a stormwater plan for a small plan for Burlington, city of Burlington. They had an issue with flooding at a couple of commercial properties that we did a small analysis for there, and lots of others. We tend to do the early studies, the alternatives analysis, and then when it goes to design, that's where the consultants take over on the floodplain side of things, on the flooding side of things. But we'll do the early studies, the updating of existing conditions, and then they'll look at we'll look at alternatives, but they'll take it to design and take it to construction. We do so many things that are kind of disparate, I'll admit. Like the transportation planning is very different. We do surveying, we do land use planning and comprehensive land use plans for our communities.
It seems to me, from what you're telling me, that all of those elements of what you do really do fit together.
What's happening
with the way we construct our roads and we, you know, use our land?
Yes, very much so. Yeah, it all fits together. Definitely land use is a big part of my appreciation of how we build. Really impacts our both our waters and our flooding and our natural resources. You know, we have a big goal to protect our environmental corridors that we've mapped for a long time, and those are always under threat from development, you know, taking little pieces here and there of our woodlands, especially our woodlands right now.
Yeah. So how are you able to advocate for that? Just with good data, good science.
Good data. And then we also do reviews at the sanitary sewer extension time. So when a new development wants to get connected up to the sanitary sewer system, we get another chance to review and really provide support to the communities and to the DNR. That's one of our major roles, and a chance to kind of remind them it's all connected. And the environmental corridors are challenging in that they are always changing. You know, some are getting bigger, some are getting smaller, just due to like the loss of our ash trees has, you know, decimated some of our forested areas that we had mapped 20, 30 years ago. And so we are always reviewing that and sending our staff out to survey that too, and try to protect our environmental corridors is a big deal to us.
Laura Cluddy Herrick is the chief environmental engineer for Sewer PAC. She spoke with WUWM's environmental reporter Susan Bentz. A new season of Bubbler Talk is on the way, but ahead of that, we need some new questions. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area at WUWM.com. Then listen for new episodes starting in May on Thursdays during Lake Effect and Fridays during Morning Edition. Coming up next, we'll learn about the craft of cheesemaking from a master cheesemaker working right here in Wisconsin. That's coming up next on Lake Effect. on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Cheese. We love it here in Wisconsin, and the numbers back it up. If Wisconsin were a country, we would rank fourth in the world in cheese production, behind the rest of the U.S., Germany, and France. Wisconsin also has the only cheesemaker program outside of Europe, and of the master cheesemakers, there are only two women. Pam Hodgson of Sartori Cheese in Plymouth, Wisconsin, is one of them. Hodgson's family have been farmers in the area since the 1840s, and the legacy of cheesemaking goes back to her grandfather. If you've been keeping up with the latest season of Top Chef, you may have seen Hodgson in Episode 3, wheeling out a table filled with Wisconsin cheese for the Top Chef kitchen. She shares what led to her becoming a master cheesemaker with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski.
My pathway to cheesemaking, it does have a couple twists and turns. Growing up, I wanted to be a dairy farmer like my parents. It did turn out that my maternal grandfather was a very accomplished cheesemaker, but when I was growing up, I knew him as Grandpa. He was already retired. So my journey to become a dairy farmer took me to University of Wisconsin-Madison, where I studied cows. Great experience. And early on in my husband and I, our farming career, we were just starting out. We needed a little bit more money to fuel the dream. So there was an opening at a cheese plant in the area for a quality assurance supervisor. I took the job, and once I was in the plant, I just fell in love with cheese making. I think it's a little bit of a joke on our family in that I had no intention of becoming a cheesemaker, but like my maternal grandfather, it turned out to be a fantastic career for me.
What were some of the things that you were immediately drawn to when you took that first job?
I loved working in the cheese plant when I started in 1991 because, one, there's always something going on. We ran milk around the clock, and when we weren't making cheese, we were cleaning the equipment that we used. So there was always something going on. I liked the satisfaction of at the end of the day, we had a cooler full of cheese that we had made. We could see the results of our hard work. And then cheese making is challenging. It's physically challenging. It can be very hard work depending on what job you're doing. It challenges a person intellectually. We always have to, as cheesemakers, we have to listen to the process and make adjustments to the process based on what the milk is doing or what the curd is doing. It's not the same every day because our major component, milk, changes a little bit every day seasonally depending on stage of lactation, environment, what cows are being fed. So there's always something to challenge a person. And then all of my cheesemaking experiences have been in plants where it was a team working together. And I really thrive and enjoy that. I enjoy working with people and seeing people develop and become more accomplished cheesemakers or more accomplished in whatever it is they want to do.
And the practice of cheesemaking itself, it's referred to as an art typically, but for you it's both an art and a science and not one or the other, right?
Correct. I think probably the right term would be craft, because there's a lot of skill, there is science, but there's also a lot of science that we haven't yet discovered. As an accomplished cheesemaker, we'll always pay close attention to the process and make adjustments as needed. And then kind of related to that, as I think about cheesemaking, how my maternal grandfather knew it compared to how I know it, over the years we've been able to harness technology to help us be more consistent. But that technology doesn't replace the eye of the cheesemaker. It doesn't replace paying attention to the process and making adjustments. What automation or technology does for us is it helps us be more consistent, but in itself, it doesn't make us better.
Exactly. And on the note of how things have shifted and changed and improved, there's obviously so many elements that go into making cheese. So we're going to focus on one of the beginning stages, which is starter bacteria. So can you explain what that is and the importance of it?
Yes. So as cheesemakers in general, there's a lot of different ways to make cheese, but when we think about cheddar or parmesan, lots of cheeses, we are using starter bacteria, which ferment the lactose in the milk, which brings the pH down, which if we think about the ancient art of cheese making, that was really important from a food preservation standpoint. So we're managing a biological process as cheesemakers. We also will add starters. The purpose isn't to convert lactose into lactic acid. They work down the line as the cheese is aging, and they'll create some of the flavors that we absolutely love in cheese because they're breaking down the proteins. It's a very interconnected process to partner with bacteria to make great cheese.
I love the way you phrase that, partner with bacteria.
Yes, and of course we want certain bacteria. We want the ones that create the flavors we want. There's plenty of bacteria out there that are safe to consume, but they don't make the flavors we want. And then there's the culprits out there that from a food safety standpoint, we absolutely build our process around preventing their inclusion in our milk.
Right. So with starter bacteria, how has this element developed or changed over time compared to, say, when your grandfather was using starters?
Yes. So when my grandfather was making cheese, he did a process which was called mothering the culture. So he would have some culture, he would grow it in small batches, and then he would grow that again. You could think of it a little bit like a process of sourdough bread, right? You're keeping back some of your starter to make the next batch of starter. And at that point, he would not have known what strains were in his starter, and he probably did not have just one strain in his starter as well. If we compare that to what we do now, is now we're using defined strains where we know what that bacteria is. We're monitoring it to make sure that its performance doesn't change over time. Growing up, I'd hear stories about how somebody's starter had failed, and they'd come to George Hintz to get his starter, and you know, cheesemakers would help each other out. And we'll also enter contests, and we'll compete really hard. And we all want to win that contest. But when the contest is over, we're also genuinely happy for whoever did win. So it's a really neat community to be part of the Wisconsin cheesemaking scene.
One thing that I imagine, say, your grandfather had to deal with was a lack of automation, like things when it comes to heat control or other processes in the cheesemaking stages. Are those good basic building blocks that allow you to be more creative in the process down the road when you are developing cheese?
Absolutely. Growing up, I would hear stories of pretty much how much my grandfather hated his wood-fired boiler because he had inconsistent steam control. So he'd be fighting that instead of focusing on cheese making. Today, we have very good control of our temperatures. And that's really important because as we work to create American originals, cheeses that will make Wisconsin proud, we need to have the control so that if we invent this great cheese and it's just fantastic, well, we have to be able to replicate it because each time a consumer comes and buys this piece of Wisconsin cheese, they want it to be the same goodness as it was last time. So automation really allows us to do that, but automation does not replace the skill and observation of a cheesemaker.
If anything, does it make the challenge of standing out even more satisfying?
So when we think about cheesemaking, it's an ancient art. I mean, it goes back millennials, right? So, and around the world, there's just thousands of different kinds of cheeses. So if we look at that and we're like, wow, we want to create American original. And that's a really big focus at Sartori. We want to create American originals. We'll look to anyone around the world for inspiration, but we don't want to copy somebody else's great cheese. We want to make our own. And even something as common as a cheddar, we'll put our own signature on it. So if you just look at it from that standpoint, it is kind of daunting to think about, well, we want to create something new that somebody else hasn't had. But what kind of grounds me on all that is the creativity process. What I find in being creative is I get very balanced on right brain and left brain activities. So part of me is like, okay, if I look at this process and how traditionally this process has been done, well, if I do what everybody else has done, I'm going to end up what everybody else already has. So how can I do it differently? And then the analytical part of me is looking at the data after we've made the cheese and made multiple vats of the cheese and understanding, well, if we make more acidity early in the process, what is the consequence later on in the finished product? So, you know, as we talked earlier about falling in love with the process, I absolutely love this part, that freedom to be creative and then also the analytical opportunities that it provides for me. So, yeah, it's a daunting challenge to come up with pleasing original cheeses, yet collectively, Wisconsin cheesemakers are up to the task.
Pam Hodgson is a master cheesemaker at Sartori Cheese in Plymouth, Wisconsin. She spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of today's conversations, or if you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll learn about the avian flu that's affecting livestock and how it could impact the dairy industry here in Wisconsin. Plus, we'll talk about the northern lights and how you might be able to spot them. That's all tomorrow at noon right here on Lake Effect. On listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.